But when she left her marriage and said, I'm going to have as much sex as I possibly can before I die, I was like, okay, great. What? Okay. And I didn't know if she really meant it, Helen. Like, I wasn't sure if, like, she really meant it. Oh, girl, she did.
Kia ora and welcome to The C Word, Kiwis Talk About Cancer. I'm your host, Helen King, and this is the podcast for cancery people. This is the second episode in a special C Word series, Not Today Cancer. Each episode, I'll be featuring an amazing woman who has found a way to give the middle finger to cancer. What I love about each of these women is that they've managed to create something really amazing and inspiring for others going through breast cancer when they're facing something pretty serious themselves. So make sure you subscribe on Spotify or iTunes so you don't miss out when each episode is live. Last week, I spoke to the fabulous Helen Addis, who created the Change and Check campaign, which is helping people all over the world regularly check their breasts. If you haven't already, go back and check out that episode. Today is pretty special for me because I got to chat with an amazing podcaster whose show had a big impact on me. Emmy Award-winning actress and singer Nikki Boyer helped capture her best friend Molly's life as Molly grappled with a terminal breast cancer diagnosis. The result is a hilarious and emotional podcast, Dying for Sex. I am so excited to talk to you about this, and I've been thinking how to start and how to ask, and I keep getting really emotional because, you know, Dying for Sex, the podcast, and then Molly's book just hit me at a different level, you know, because I've read so much about, you know, about cancer and people's experiences, but there was something about Molly and something about some of the experiences that she had that just hit me on a different level. I just found the podcast, you know, there was something so intensely personal about being present for somebody's death, essentially, that it was like, I just thought it was really powerful being able to almost be a witness to that.
Thank you for saying that. I feel like I was having my own moment, like you were having, while I was in that experience with her. Of course, some days it just felt like it's my life with Molly, right? It's just our life and this is what we do. And then I'd zoom out every once in a while and go, what is happening? Oh my gosh, where are we in this together? And are these her final days? No, they're not her final days. There can't be her final days. Are they her final days? And then we just sink back into our present fun day-to-day life. But something I noticed along the way is that your threshold for what is normal shifts and changes. And so going to lunch with her and having to tend to her sickness and what she needed to eat and how we needed to pace our lunch, it just became the norm. It wasn't, oh, my friend has cancer, this is what we do. It was like, oh, this is what we do because she's just my friend. So your barometer changes or your center changes. And I don't think I realized how far down the road we had gone together until, I really think until listening back to the podcast myself.
Yeah, because I imagine, it's one thing to be doing that with a friend or a loved one and going through those steps of someone with a terminal diagnosis. But, you know, I know as someone who has been a journalist that when you are putting together a story, there's a deeper level to that. So I could only imagine that there would have been more of an awareness of what was going on.
I think when we were recording the podcast, so I just want to let you know, when we recorded the podcast, we recorded 10 episodes and we just kind of got together and talked about the sexual escapades. And then she got very ill in that October and we couldn't record anymore. And then the story sort of shifted from Molly's sexual escapades and a little bit of her history into, oh, Molly's in the hospital and I'm not sure if she's coming home. So the journalist in me and the best friend in me that knew she wanted the story to be shared, I thought, well, let's schedule time to record. still. Like, the story is now pivoting and changing. And she was very open to that. And so that's where episode 5 and episode 6 sort of come from. But keep in mind, I brought these raw recordings to Wondery, which is where the podcast was, you know, developed. And they paired me up with Stephanie Jens, my executive producer, who was a game changer. She was able to take those recordings plus Molly's book and interviews with me, and we spent hours and hours on the phone, and she helped me shape those 6 episodes into the story that you hear. So I don't even know if I was, Helen, I don't think I was even aware of the story that I was a part of while it was happening, because I was just in it, right? Like we do.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think I mentioned before that I felt like it was just this intensely intimate experience in those those last 2 episodes. I just, I actually had to wait a few weeks before I listened to them because I knew what was coming. And I think when you've been through, being through cancer as a younger woman or younger person, I think those feelings were there. And then knowing that Molly's story ends, and it ends with her death, it was quite emotional. But I was so curious to know what it was like for you being present for that, being present for your beloved friend having a terminal illness.
It was life-changing for me. Gosh, it really was. I think in the moments of her illness when, we were functioning in the real world and she'd have, really good days and then really, really bad days. And I was present for a lot. I wasn't there all the time, but once she hit the hospital, it was very much is she coming out? And if she wasn't going to come out, what were we going to make these last few months look and feel like? In the process of these last few months in the hospital, Molly was very mindful, still wanting to be creative and still wanting to work and write. And I felt 50-50 to answer your question. There was part of me that was just the friend, right? I'm your friend. I bring food. I do what I'm supposed to. I visit every few days because I know your family needs time. I help with your mom. I do the laundry. I bring you soup. I was just the friend. And then there was another part of me that knew there was this bigger purpose and this bigger thing happening. I would sort of teeter between both of those worlds. And it was hard. There were days where, I had to juggle work and my life and my stepchildren and my dog and still wanting to be Molly's person. And it was really difficult to balance that at times. But as soon as I would walk into her hospital room, all of the outside world would just melt off of me and I would just sink right into her. So I think I knew something really magical was happening, because getting to be a part of someone's death is a gift that I don't even know how to put words to it, but I am forever changed because of that. And it was extremely hard on me, but it was so profound and spiritual and beautiful that in a weird way, that's going to sound crazy, I feel closer to her now than I did in our friendship, because we went through a death together. And now I feel her very much with me. And there is a soul connection that feels deeper than it did when we were limited to our earthly worlds. That sounds so airy fairy. I'm sorry, but that's really how I feel. Right.
Because I read her book afterwards, and I find it really hard to finish things if I know that it was things like, I loved the series The Wire, but I knew one of my favorite characters got killed off, and so I just couldn't finish the series because I couldn't bear to think of watching it. And so I found it hard to read all of it because I knew what was happening. But after listening to the podcast and then reading her book and getting more of an insight into Molly, and then realizing that that I had more in common with her than I thought I did, it just, it really hit a lot harder. And to be, and to sort of watch this person's process of dealing with her past, dealing with her mother, relationship with her mother, and then seeing how the sexual exploration of the podcast actually made much more, it had a much more meaning to it after reading the book.
I'm glad that you felt that way. I do feel like anybody who wants to know sort of the flip side of the coin, to really, to read her book and to get, you know, I think it's a little bit of, it answers a lot of the why questions that people have. But one thing you just said is that, like, she let us in on her process, which I think is so beautiful, because as an actress and an artist, it's like, I want you to see the outcome. I don't want you to see my process. That's messy. Mm. But Molly was really okay with allowing people into her process. And I just found that to be so brave. And I think even writing that book, I mean, writing the book almost even reveals more of the quote unquote ugly parts in the process. And I thought it was just such a, I don't know, a beautiful way of honoring the good, the bad, and the ugly of life. And I'm so glad that you read it. I can only imagine how hard that is, being someone that has dealt with cancer and reading. Does it feel comforting or does it feel scary? Like, what are both?
It was a little bit of both, because I think when you have a cancer diagnosis, you're facing your mortality. And so, and there's so much, I don't know if it's similar in the States, but in New Zealand, so much of the rhetoric, especially around breast cancer, is about beating cancer and survivorship. And when someone dies, they lost their battle with cancer.
My gosh, Molly hated that shit. She hated that.
Yeah, I hate it too, because cancer isn't pink and pretty, you know, it is brutal. And so I guess it comforted me to sort of, you know, somebody else who battled through it. But I think there is a comfort in knowing that someone felt at peace at that end bit, because I think when you are in that fear initially of, holy shit, am I going to die? It's very, very frightening. And so the more, for me, when I had talked to people with terminal cancer, or, you know, have access to, you know, amazing memoirs like Molly's, it sort of, it helps make it a little less frightening.
Okay. That's interesting. Mm. Yeah. I always worry. I always wonder when I recommend the podcast to someone who has had cancer or has cancer. I'm like, I don't know where they're going to fall, but I have to say the majority of the messages that I get from people is, oh my gosh, thank you. This is like, this is amazing. And it's so helpful. And I'm like, oh, okay, good. Thank God, you know, cause I don't want to pretend to know what it feels like to have a terminal diagnosis. Everybody's so personal in their process of how they deal with that. So, but I think 90% of the people that have responded have had that same thing that you just mentioned. That makes me so happy. She would love to know that sharing her process has helped other people.
Yeah, I'm getting chills, which is funny because it's so hot here. But I think even more, so just for listeners to have some context, so Molly had been diagnosed with cancer and obviously it comes back and she leaves her marriage, and then she goes on this amazing sort of sexual exploration, which is just so interesting to listen to.
I know.
And that's kind of the context, but then there's so much more to it. And so I would love to talk a little bit about what it was like for you kind of talking about that stuff and kind of knowing what Molly was up to.
Listen, Molly and I have been friends since our 20s, so we were no strangers to talking about sex and boys and, you know, being desired and our experiences and blowjobs and all of that. Like, that was kind of par for the course. But when she left her marriage and said, I'm going to have as much sex as I possibly can before I die, I was like, okay, great. What? Okay. And I didn't know if she really meant it, Helen. Like, I wasn't sure if, like, she really meant it. Oh, girl, she did. So she got on Tinder. And I mean, she was doing, if you read her book and you listen to the podcast, she was exploring digitally a little bit before actually moving out of her house with her ex-husband. But she went for it. And I mean, she made it her full-time job. Taking care of her health was A, and then juggling all of these men was B. And there were times where I was a little concerned because I was like, where are you going at 2 a.m? Like, who goes on a date at 2 a.m. or at 6 a.m? I picked her the day that we came up with the idea for the show. I had picked her up to go to lunch, and it was like 11:30. We were going to like old people lunch. You know, we were like, let's go. We had like 3-hour lunches. Yeah. So She looked really cute when she got out of the car. And I was like, why? You didn't tell me this was a cute day. Like, I didn't know we were dressing up. She's like, well, I just got back from a date. And I'm like, this morning? She's like, well, actually, it was my second date. And I'm like, what? So she had gone on two dates, like an early morning coffee and then like a breakfast thing. I think she was in the Dunkin' Donuts parking lot, like making out or giving a hand job. I don't know what she was doing, but I was like, oh my God, by that time I, you know, barely had my tea, but she, so that's the day I kind of came up with this idea of what you're doing is so out of the box, so out of the ordinary. I think there's something here. And she goes, really? Like, it didn't even dawn on her that this was out of the ordinary, because for her, she was just living her life and not even thinking what it looked like to other people or what it looked like. She didn't care about that. And that, I think, is what people are attracted to in Molly, is that she doesn't, it's not pretty. The reason that she was leaning into the sex, once you find out, is really messy and it's the ugly side of life. But she was okay with it because she figured, why not? Like, what do I have to lose here?
I read in one of your interviews, and I really related to it, that it's almost that need to, I don't know if it's finding meaning of your diagnosis, but wanting to, once you're out the other end, or, you know, or during, to do something that, I don't know, sort of has a meaning to it, or provides something to anchor yourself in. Yeah.
Because I think for me, I feel like by doing stuff, like by doing the campaigning, I feel like if somebody talks to me about cancer, it's not that they're talking to me about the positive things that I'm doing, not about the negative things that happened to me. So it helps to be able to give it that kind of positive spin. And also it makes me feel a bit like, in your face, cancer. Like, you did not, you picked on the wrong person. And do you know what I mean, though? Because I just didn't want that whole, oh, poor me, I've had cancer.
Yes. Because I don't have children, so I, you know, I guess in that way, you know, I haven't had the experience of having to navigate children through a parent's cancer diagnosis. But I imagine that adds an extra layer of complexity, the need for it to, I don't know, mean something or not be.
Yeah, I think, yeah, that was really hard. I'll never forget the day that I was told that I had cancer, and a friend had come over to look after the kids while I went to see the consultant with my husband. And when we came back, it was so strange when I first walked in the room, because I thought, you've got no idea. Because at this point, we didn't know what the story was, what the outcome was going to be. And I thought, you've got no idea what's going on. And the little fuckers were there, and they were moaning about, because I've made them a curry, a chicken curry.
Yeah.
I'm like, Mom, why did you make me a chicken curry? I don't like chicken curry. I said to my husband, if I told them that I've got cancer, do you think they might just shut the fuck up and eat it? And he was like, I don't reckon that cancer's going to sort out their behaviour. And it didn't. But it was the hardest part of the journey, because it's not just you that gets a diagnosis. It's, and it should be the same for you as well, you know, with your close friends or family that you had around you. It's not just you. It does affect those around you as well, doesn't it?
Yes.
People worry about you and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it's hard for children to process it, because I have a nephew who I'm quite close with, and I've told this story before, that Mum and I were in the car one day and Lucien was in the back seat, and out of nowhere he goes, did you have your arm removed? No. I said, I got sick. I had a bug, and the doctors needed to take my breast off. And as soon as I said breast, he was like, oh, yeah. Yeah.
How old is he? How old?
He would have been about 6 or 7 at the time.
Cute.
Yeah. Cute. So I just imagine for months that he was looking at me going, gosh, they put that arm back on well.
Even now, so I'm like, I've had some reconstruction done well, in that I had an expander put in. So I've got like one 42-year-old boob that's like, I've fed three children and I look a bit sorry for myself. And then I've got this sort of shiny brand new mound that's a lot higher up, but it's got no nipple on it. And if when I get changed, so often my youngest will say to me, where has that gone? What's happening with it? Are you going to grow a new one? Should we buy you a new one? Oh. And they used to think, did you have a port?
Yes.
To have your, yeah. So I had a port here in my arm and it would stick out quite a lot. Mm. They thought that my nipple had fallen off and that was it under the skin there. And then we had another day when we had an Amazon delivery guy come and my youngest, Belle, who was six at the time, was obsessed about the fact that I only had one boob. And whilst I was signing for this package, she said to the delivery man, she said to me, show him that you've just got one boob, one booby. And I was like, no, he doesn't need to see that. She said, no, don't show him the good one. Show him the one that's not there anymore. I was like, let's not. Please tell the delivery driver about that. Oh. And then she, I don't know if you ever had a prosthetic, like a softy boob. When I was getting her reading book out of her school bag one day, she'd taken it into school for a show and tell. My boob.
It's
that nice. and my toothbrush, which was the thought that my toothbrush had gone into her classroom. I was like, oh. Because I didn't wear it all the time. I didn't wear the fake boob. It was only if I was on special occasions.
Yeah.
If I was going out, I might like try and even myself up a bit.
Yes. Oh, that is hilarious. Mm. Now, I am always, I guess I'm interested because I didn't have to deal with this. But, you mentioned that the chemotherapy really impacted you and it was, you know, really tough going. How do you navigate parenting when you're that ill?
I found it was probably the hardest part because it's on one hand they made me get on with it because they didn't start behaving, they didn't stop trying to kill each other just because I had cancer and I wasn't feeling that well. So it would take my mind off of it. So I spent a lot of my time, you know, still parenting. But there were some days where, like you, I couldn't get out of bed. And on one occasion, my nine-year-old son came in. He had to go to school. And he was just stood at the end of my bed. And I was like, what is it? What's the matter? And he said, will you be here when I get home? It's like, yeah, of course I'll be here. And it was that point that I realised, even if I felt awful every morning, I would make sure I got up, I'd shove a load of makeup on, see them off to school, and then just crash in bed, and then do the same again to pick them up, because it just helped them, I think, gave them a bit of reassurance, I suppose. And because of the age that they were at, the only thing they know about cancer is death.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so that was hard. And we did, this is really sad, and I don't want to be all sad sack about this, but my son had, I'd looked in the Google history on our laptop and he had Googled what will happen the week before my mum dies of breast cancer.
Oh.
So it really made me realise how he was thinking. So we really opened up our conversation about it in the house and I stopped having phone calls with the doctor behind closed doors. You know, it was just like, I'm just going to talk to the doctor. Yes, hello. You know, and it was just all part of all our lives.
Mm.
And whilst it was very difficult. They were very, they kept me going as well. But I have no solid, like, this is the way to deal with it if anybody's listening has got kids going through this. But the one thing I would say, if my kids were 5, 7, and 9 at the time, and just being open and honest really, really helped.
Yeah, because they're pretty perceptive, aren't they?
Oh, my God, they really are.
Yeah.
They really, really are. And it's very difficult to hide anything from them. They know you so well. Mm. So I never spoke about death. But, you know, I answered their questions honestly, you know, if they asked me stuff.
Yeah.
I said that, actually, I didn't, because one of them asked, you know, are you going to die?
Yeah.
So, no, I'm not going to die. No, no. I'm stupid.
Yeah.
It's just my instant reaction. Not that I had any intention of doing that, but I was just, you know, you just want to protect them, don't you?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. I can't help but feel it's a very English reaction. Don't be stupid.
Oh, it is totally very, yeah, very stiff upper lip. Like, yes. Oh, no, darling. No, 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 no. That's not us. No.
We don't do that.
Yeah. Yeah. That is very British. That is so British.
Yes.
Right. We apologise for everything and we cue for everything as well.
Cue very well, though.
Very well.
Yeah, good cueers in the UK.
I'll tell you a story about cueing. When we weren't very well, when I wasn't very well, we went to like a theme park with the kids. And, you know, you have to cue for ages to go on these rides, and my 9-year-old said, if you tell them that you've got cancer, do you think we could get to the front of the queue? And I'm like, oh right, so my cancer suits you now, does it? Don't get me wrong, we did it.
Yeah, I was gonna say, you gotta pull the cancer sometimes.
Oh my god, yeah. Don't work anymore though, unfortunately.
Bloody hell, what were they thinking? So you mentioned before, what next? Have you got anything in the pipeline? COVID kind of has pulled the rug out from under.
The COVID really has. And actually our medical system over here is, I wouldn't say dire straits, but it's not in the best shape at the moment. Cancer screenings are very behind at the moment, because obviously there's been other things going on. So what's next? My plan is we have a building here, quite a famous building called the O2, which is a huge semicircular dome. It's like a big arena place, and you can actually climb it. So I'm going to have it lit up like a boob, and I'm going to climb it with the 46 women that have come forward. Yeah. And yeah, we're going to all climb it together, and we're going to put a big... So I'm trying to get a nipple made to go on top of this massive dome. My Google history on my computer is so weird at the moment, because it's like life-size inflatable nipple. How to make an enormous nipple. All this sort of stuff. We're trying to do it. So as soon as the COVID bans are lifted, hopefully that's the plan. And I have an invitation to go to Parliament as well to speak to our MPs about trying to get the sticker out into as many council-led buildings across the UK, so that we hit all socio-economic groups and ethnicities. And, yeah, it's so important that we hit all communities of every level.
It is. And I sort of wanted to sort of backtrack a bit and touch on that for a moment, because I saw one of your interviews from On Lorraine, which is the show that you work on, and where you talked about, you mentioned it before, about how most of your friends didn't check. So I have been a sporadic checker, and that is how I found my lump was in the shower doing a you know, what's that? But also knowing that that wasn't normal for my breast to have this strange lump there. And I think that, excuse me, is such an important point. And I guess the center of the change and check is that if you know your boobs, if you know what your breasts feel like, then if you feel something unusual or if it, because it's not always a lump, then you know that you can go and get that checked.
That's absolutely. The campaign isn't necessarily about finding a symptom. It is trying to encourage people to know what their normal is. I think that's the most important thing. Know your body, know what is normal for you and what is normal for your body, so that if you develop a persistent cough or if you start bleeding from somewhere that you know, persistently, that you know you shouldn't be bleeding from there, or you do develop a lump anywhere on your body, get it checked out, you know. And it's just so important. So when it comes to breasts, I say, you know, once a month you should be checking, and check at the end of your period, like the last day of your period, because that's when your boobs tend to hormonally calm down a bit. And yeah, just get that sort of baseline check, so you know that if you then see any puckering or any dimpling or any discharge or anything, you know, that wasn't there a month ago. It saves lives. It's as simple as that. It saves lives.
It does. And I can't wait to see you and your 46 woman on the giant boob.
I know. we were supposed to do it before COVID hit.
Yeah.
It was set up, good to go. We were going to do it live on telly, and but it didn't work out. But we will do it for sure.
Yeah. And I think that's such an important message as well, because although we have been very lucky in New Zealand, and I know because I follow the fabulous people from You, Me and the Bee.
Oh, You, Me and the Bee. They're fantastic. Yeah. They're lovely.
Yes. And so I've been following them since I had chemo. And for anyone who doesn't know, I'll post up links in the show notes. But I know that the UK has just been slammed with COVID, and it has really impacted the cancer community and also diagnosis and things. So in New Zealand, we are lucky it hasn't quite got to that point, but I do know, you know, people have been behind in their smear tests, and they did get behind in screening. So that's why these reminders that actually we can take this, you know, we can do this ourselves. We can check ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, I had my smear test today. That was fun. That's the first time I've been out for a long time. smear tests are down 600. Basically, 600,000 people have missed their screening during COVID here because people are too scared to go to the doctors.
Yeah,
that's a big problem.
Yeah, and there's similar stats here actually, and we have really bad rates of cervical cancer. So
yeah,
and I'm sort of thinking, I'm 6 months behind. Go and get your smear test.
Go and do it. Honestly. Yeah. The woman that did mine today, she did not stop talking the whole way. I was just like, can you just like concentrate on what you're doing? She kept like coming up and carrying on the conversation with me. I'm like, just like walk and talk, like do it while you're doing it.
That's really disconcerting.
Really disconcerting.
So you're looking down there, that you're looking
right. I know. And then she keeps coming up over the thing saying, you know, we were just talking about the weather or something. I was just like, just
do it.
Finish it already.
Well, OG of Change and Check. Now you can add that to your,
OG. I want a badge or I want a sash.
Yeah.
Something to, I love that. I'm the OG.
Yes. Thank you for coming and talking about the amazing campaign, because I think
thank you so much for having me.
And I will put up, I'll take a screen grab, because Helen has lovely boobs on her wall.
They're not any old boobs, they're neon boobs. Although it kind of looks a bit funny on this picture. It's better on my phone, but
So Helen and her neon boobs. I will post
love it
because they're lovely. So if people want to find out more about you, because you have a fantastic Instagram page, where can people find you?
So I'm called The Titty Gritty on Instagram. And yeah, that's where I am, normally doing weird things with boobs.
Excellent.
I'm sure I'm going to get arrested one day for all my boob shenanigans, but there we go.
Well, thank you so much. I will throw up some links to that so people can come and check out your boobs on Instagram. Thanks for joining me. Next week on the last installment of Not Today Cancer, a C-word special, I talk to a young Australian woman who at just 27 was diagnosed with breast cancer and is now helping others get honest about what having breast cancer is really like. Next month, I'm going to be presenting at the PodFest Global Online Summit. If you're interested in coming along and hearing me talk, I'll be sharing how I took a shitty experience like cancer and turned it into a podcast and all the lessons that I've learned on the way about podcasting, interviewing, and creating a space where people can share authentic stories and their authentic experiences. I'll chuck the details down in the show notes and I'll provide a link to where you can grab tickets and also my special promo code, which will give you a free entry level pass. My special promo code is CWordPodFest, all in caps. I would love to see you there, and there will be hundreds of amazing presenters, and you'll get to hear from all sorts of really interesting people about how they podcast. Don't miss it. It's going to be a great event. The C Word Kiwis Talk About Cancer is every Sunday at 11:55 a.m. on Auckland's 104.6 Planet FM and anytime at www.planetaudio.org.nz/the C Word. See you next time.
Take the brother out for being rude. And like I said before, I was mad about it. And took three or four cops to pull me off. You got me losing everything. My eyes, then I can't see. Get away from the bar. danger. And she is blind to me, that's why I'm asking B. So let's party, B. Come and dance with me.
Dream.